One of the things that strikes me is so many anthropology students study intersection of their own identity much more often than a biologist or any other field for the most part. I can't tell you the number of folks I've talked to in graduate school that I study this thing because either my parents were like that, or I grew up in this place, or I've always wanted to know about this thing, or whatever it is. There really is this interesting connection, something that I actually always felt a little weird about for myself because I did research on quinoa production in Peru, and I'm not neither Peruvian nor am I made of quinoa. But you know, as much as I like hipster foods, as a flip side, it's just that. And it's an interesting piece of how often we do see identity tied up with what graduate students, anthropologists tend to study.
It's a good point, because in some ways it's like being an artist, where artists are expressing themselves through their art. And anthropology is such a personal discipline, because a big part of it is developing personal relationships, that I can definitely think back and realize that my work as an anthropologist has definitely been impacted by my personal experience and also to some degree my identity.
Hey folks, welcome to This Anthro Life. I'm your host, Adam Gamwell. Today, I'm joined by my colleagues and friends, Phil Searles and Astrid County, for a conversation that gets at the heart of why we study what we study at school, why we pursue the disciplines that speak to us, and how our changing sense of identity, who we are, shapes and is changed by our fields of study. Phil will take us through his own story as an art school kid, all the way to business anthropologist that's obsessed with business ethics, and helps us unpack an often unarticulated journey. But by understanding how our identities and career paths impact each other, we can further understand how to ready and frame ourselves for public impact. Phil helps us break down the differences between public intellectuals, thought leaders, and activists to reveal how each of us can create the impact we want with our work. So, I'll let us get back to it.
So interesting that you are both liking it to being an artist, because I actually felt like it was more about me being a scientist. Like, I felt, okay, it's my turn to add to the canon of knowledge. What is it that I see that's not there? And what can I do that's unique that maybe I can do in a way that somebody else can't? And so identity and then experiences and stuff is part of that. But I was thinking of it more, I don't see research on this, so let me go do it.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is why we study what we study. So for example, I studied semiotics because I was always interested in branding. I never really wanted to work as an academic anthropologist. I wanted to work in industry and advertising. All the way back to my very first words, this is NBC.
Those were your first words?
Those were your first words?
Yeah. It was a station ID, because back in the day, they couldn't do the superimposition with computer graphics the way they do now, like during a TV show or whatever. So whenever there was a show that was about to come on or go off, you would have a station ID that was a screen that would come on and it would say, this is CBS. Or you're watching CBS, or this is NBC. And so I grew up infatuated with that peacock logo. And those were my very first words. And so my work as an anthropologist tends to study branding, technology, media, and I think that's a big part, and branding, really. So I think that's definitely informed what I choose to study, because when you are an anthropologist, you have the benefit, and it can kind of be a double-edged sword, but if you are somebody who likes to create structure from ambiguity, you can create your own structure much more than maybe any other field. And so everything I studied and did was informed by my passions and my interests. But I think there's a good point there, because the expression part is a big part of, I think, what's missing from academia, where we will express ourselves to each other using the poetry of academies. And I like it as well. My undergraduate major was called Semiology of Visual Culture. And that's something where maybe 2% of people know what that means. But I think that people who work in academia or decide to be scientists tend to be oriented towards understanding. And people who are more artistically oriented understand themselves through how they express themselves. So I feel like it's very difficult for people to do both. You have some people like Einstein, who was a pianist and a violinist, or Brian May, who is one of the greatest guitarists and songwriters, but he's also an astrophysicist. But I think that's actually ties into my current work with Adam, and a couple of other anthropologists really focused on public intellectualism, really focused on helping anthropologists express ourselves outside of the academy. So I think that is a good point where we aren't necessarily thinking about expression as much as we should, or we're not thinking about it thoughtfully enough to have a societal impact. And even sometimes there isn't even the interest in having a societal impact. That's even looked down upon sometimes. But I think that my interest has informed what I choose to study. And now I'm circling back because I went to art school as a teenager. And so now I get to try to draw on my understanding that comes from anthropology and other disciplines and express that in a way that's going to be impactful.
That's really powerful to think about. So I'm curious to get your thoughts on this. A friend of mine who is a multimedia artist, I was talking to her a few months ago, and I had an idea for if I was to make some photographs of an art series. It's funny, I don't count myself as an artist, but I guess I am. I'm a musician, which I is an artist, but I'm being unfair to myself since I also make a podcast. But I had an idea for this kind of installation that would be around the way that migrants are invisibilized. And I explained the idea to her and what I was thinking. And she said to me that one of the main things about art that's important to keep in mind is that it's made for everyone to experience. And your idea is, I think it was maybe a little bit too intellectual, was maybe how she had said it. And I recognize that that's her perspective. But at the same time, though, that really struck me as that's a really interesting idea. So I'm curious how that rings to you in terms of thinking about how we use our work as a form of expression, if we're artistically inclined, for example. And then what is art for, I guess? That's like a super broad question. What is it that you want to accomplish with art, with your work or with your research, or how might that inform your process?
Yeah, I think that my answer to that ties into how I got into anthropology and going to art school and switching my interest from art to science, because the more interested I got in art, the more I had to understand the science behind it. And that's really where anthropology comes in, because my interest in art is what led me to become an anthropologist, and I ended up studying a scientific project. So now it's just all kind of come together through anthropology.
That to me is a fascinating tale of just going from the peacock. So what I want to hear more about is your eternal desire to always work in industry. That's interesting. We don't hear that very often, that a lot of people that study anthropology want to do that. But what you're already sharing with us with your story is that you did art school. So I'd like to hear a bit about that. And then just think about this, of like how anthropology for you has always been this industrial or this making enterprise versus something that we're just there to study. I think it is quite refreshing. I know that our listeners want to hear more about, just because we know that. Most people think of anthropology as something they study and then decide not to go to academia because they realize they don't like it or can't.
Yeah, that's a great, I think that would be a useful way to think about. So I was really an applied anthropologist before I knew what applied anthropology was. I saw it as a means to do what I wanted to do in industry from the beginning. And back when I was a teenager, I was really interested in writing. I was also interested in the visual arts and music. So I went to Interlochen Arts Academy in Northern Michigan, and I ended up studying a whole bunch of disciplines and getting really interested in what brought them together, which was that they were all forms of communication, and that communication had meaning as a result of associations that we were making in our mind, and that was informed by culture. So I ended up going to the University of Michigan and attending the residential college, the RC, also known as the Artsy, because this is where all the misfits were, the artsy misfits. We didn't get letter grades. We got narrative, like paragraph grades. And we would take a lot of humanities types of courses. And that was where I designed this major called Semiology of Visual Culture, where I could study how symbolic communication works within visual culture, whether it's the performing arts, film, advertising, television. So I always saw it as a means to an end, and that end would be working in industry in some way. When I was a freshman in college, I took two introductory courses that really stuck out in my mind as being instrumental to my work now. One was Introduction to Psychology. And then the second semester of my freshman year, I took Anthropology 101. And in that course, I saw a film called Anthropologist at Work. And the producer of that is an anthropologist named Elizabeth Briody. And she worked at GM. So I grew up for several years in Michigan. I didn't just go to art school as a teenager at Interlochen Arts Academy. I also lived in Flint when I was a kid, and I was obsessed with cars and going to Detroit, and this gives you a sense of how old I am. Detroit was like the city back then. I was just infatuated with Detroit. And I was living in Flint as well, and it was a very different place when I was there. And Elizabeth Briody is an anthropologist who worked at GM for many years. And so when I saw that, it occurred to me that this is somebody who was doing the kind of work that I could do. I could work in a place like GM as an anthropologist. So I was interested both in the strategy and branding side, interested in technology, and I was also interested in organizations. So for a while, I thought I might go into organizational psychology, but then I really just ended up realizing that anthropology was the vehicle to merge all of my interest, not having to choose between art or science, but understanding how I could integrate them holistically, understanding the humanities side, but also the technology or the hard physical side of things. And that's what anthropology is known for, being a holistic field of study. And working as a consultant, holism is a theme that is always coming up. So it's very fitting, I think, now that I work as a consultant, because especially as a result of all the cultural change that has happened and the needs of organizations, the anthropology can be useful from the standpoint of methodology. So using ethnographic methods, but even our ethics, I think, are really important to industry. And that's something that is evident now. I think that there's been such a focus on economic capital that it's come at the expense of social and human and environmental capital. And it's something you can't really ignore anymore, particularly when you look at what happened with the pandemic. 2020 started off with a bunch of fires. Then you have a riot at the Capitol. You have all of this tension around systemic racism that's manifesting itself very dramatically. So you can't really ignore the systemic issues that anthropologists and other human scientists are so good at understanding. I think where we need to be better is explaining. And I think that's probably where there needs to be more collaboration between art and science. We need to be learning from people who have been able to, and I won't name any names, but basically learning from people who are able to express themselves in compelling ways and have a societal impact, even though they have really bad ideas. In academia, oftentimes our ideas are good, but they aren't received. You don't know how to communicate them. And even within academia, you have people who don't really want to address practical issues. And that's fine. I started off as just being really steeped in theory and semiotics, but that was the way I was able to learn how to be a consultant, learn how to help humanize industry. And I think that's really where anthropologists, it's implicit now. People talk about ethnographic research, how anthropology is integrated into tech ethics and AI development and AR and VR. But I really think that we're at a point where industry and really capitalism has to be humanized. We're realizing that it's not something that's a nice to have. It's a need. It's a human need. And so I feel like that's why the pendulum is swinging back, even when it comes to just public intellectualism in general. So I think that's tying into the work that we're doing. Adam, Elizabeth Briody, Don Lehman, Joe Aiken, working on this project called Anthropology on the Public Stage. And what we're realizing is that there is this swing back towards public intellectualism after years where there's been a bit of scarcity. This is not like the mid-20th century where you have people like Marvin Harris and Margaret Mead, but we're coming back and hopefully leveraging a lot of new technologies. So for example, Zencastr that we're using right now, podcasting, things like Clubhouse, and so on. Mm-hmm. So it's a really exciting time to be at that intersection of art and science.
I think that some of the points you were making about your own evolution into anthropology as this interest in art that started to produce this curiosity about their intersections and how that made you more interested in science and how you found this path through anthropology to actually make these things real is really relevant to this point that you're bringing up about ethics, because, and I'm just guessing, but I think that this separation of the two from art and science as being treated as separate entities and separate paths is actually why we're having a hard time integrating ethics into everything we're doing and why it's become such a scarcity and such a need to start having these conversations again, because it seems like there is definitely something about that interplay that was a really big part of your path that is missing for a lot of other people. And then you can scale that out and say is missing in a lot of organizations and institutions and at the societal level as well. What do you think about that, Phil?
I think that's right. right. I think that it is missing, but it's also getting more difficult to ignore that it's missing. It's becoming very apparent where now one of the reasons anthropologists are sought after is it's not just because people are really interested in semiotics. It's because they need to fix problems that have real world implications for people at organizations and customers and the success of companies. And I think that need for thinking holistically about how we think about things like capital and success is something that is creating a need, or at least a recognition that there is a need. There's always been the need for anthropology, but it's becoming pretty obvious now. And so one of the reasons I still identify as an anthropologist, regardless of whether I'm working as a UX researcher or innovation strategist, is because it has original sin. It was an applied field very early on as a way to make colonization better. But that's really made us very critical in many ways. Sometimes we need to be much more critical. But I think ethically very rigorous, and those ethics needs to be applied elsewhere. So one of the reasons I think it's important for anthropologists to work outside of academia is that your hands are not clean just because you're working within academia. You're still embedded in capitalistic systems that are extremely destructive. And it's, in some ways, it can be a form of activism. And for me to be motivated, I have to really be passionate about doing something. So working as an anthropologist in industry and taking a very nonlinear path, so going from brand strategy, organizational culture, user experience, thought leadership, doing so many different kinds of roles, it forces you to learn a lot very quickly. But it also is something where you have a bit of autonomy as well. So you can push back when you need to and learn how to push back tactfully and realize that it's not necessarily going to encumber work. It's going to enhance work when you're thinking about those issues, especially anthropological methods are being embraced. That needs to come with the ethical toolkit. And that's also something I think is recognized in society more. And you even see it with branding research. People want to support organizations and brands that think about their impact holistically and thoughtfully. And it might be too optimistic, but I feel like there is enough evidence. There are these bits and pieces where you hear people talking about positive marketing and supercorps and all these things. Some of it is just thought leadership marketing, but I think that the big difference between people who come with that rigor of being an anthropologist is that other side of from thought leadership, which is really public intellectualism, where you can criticize things and you can be practical, but you can also problematize, but also solve problems. You have to choose. So I think that's what I've learned how to do with my career, especially since graduate school, where I studied a really interesting big science project with lots of ethical and applied anthropology implications. I had to learn how to navigate all of these different industries. So that's made me able to just make it so that my perspective is something that adds value, even though it's also not something where I'm compromising my ethics at all.
I think that's such an important and powerful way to reflect on your work. Most everything you said struck me. But one thing I wanted to call out is that even in the work of consulting, itself can be a form of activism and the idea of tactfully pushing back. And your perspective as an anthropologist, as a social scientist, as an artist and scientist itself is what informs the way that you do your work. And I just want to echo this. I think this is an incredibly important message for anybody thinking about doing anthropological work, or if you're a business contemplating, why would I hire an anthropologist or how do I do it? This is the best part. You can hire a consultant. You can hire a designer. If the person is an anthropologist also by training and by dint of it, they might bring these kinds of pieces to the tables. Again, I really like this idea that one, your hands aren't clean just because you're in academia and we still operate in the same systems of capitalism. And then consulting for you, it sounds like it can be a form of activism too. I think it's refreshing and nice and true. I guess it's not just nice today, but it's actually true. And it's a needed perspective that in your larger quest that I also share with you about how do we help public intellectuals, especially social scientists, pick up that mantle and spread the word and learn how to communicate in more effective ways to more kinds of audiences, businesses, people, laypersons. There's something interesting about treating this as a form of activism. So I'd love to hear you rap a little bit more about that and what you think in this work about activism and ethics?
Sure. So I still have not ever shaken that kind of philosophical, theoretical inclination. So I'm still interested in semiology and semiotics and moral philosophy and human rights. That's never going to leave my perspective. So when I'm brought onto a project, I've had to learn how to communicate that. And this also touches on this idea of public intellectualism, where you have to learn to code switch, basically. I mean, anthropologists, we're the best at studying it. We need to be the best at doing it. And basically, thinking about my background, I've had a lot of different experiences that have enabled me to have empathy for people who are disenfranchised and overlooked and underserved. And I lean into that. I don't try to get away from that because that's who I am. And I'm an anthropologist. And so I've learned to take that in. In industry, sometimes you can see what makes us very human can also be what makes us forget that we're human, which is culture. And we end up behaving in these normative ways that don't make any sense and they're destructive and that hurt people. And when you are integrated into an organization, one, generally, they're going to realize that there's a need for that. Not everybody's going to get into a conversation with an anthropologist and say, yeah, we need to have this person on our team. But a lot of people do. And it's very often people who you would not expect. You'd be surprised how many really bombastic CEOs in various industries like advertising who love anthropology because they understand their industry and how to be successful in their industry to a degree where they understand that they need anthropology. It's a very practical thing. And so when you go into those kinds of organizations, as a result of the fact that you can help them generate insights that are going to help them be really successful or develop strategies that are going to be really meaningful, you can make sure that you're bringing in the other part, which is that ethical perspective and building your own brand within an organization where you can push back, but basically that can be part of your brand. And it's not necessarily going to be something that needs to be encumbering if you are working in the right organization. And so that's one of the really cool things about consulting where, you know, you're never co-opted. You're never beholden to any kind of organization. You have a bit of autonomy. But then there are also other organizations that get it. I've had conversations with people looking for anthropologists where the person doing the recruiting is talking in a way that would have gone over my head after my undergraduate work, talking about stuff like reflexivity and stuff like this. And it's really fascinating to see how much anthropology has been integrated into industry, even though a lot more does, because right now the focus, I think, is just on the methods like semiotic analysis, which is commoditized, but ethnography is to a degree as well. I feel like anthropologists have a responsibility to behave ethically. And for me, behaving ethically is not standing back and problematizing and pointing out all the problems that anthropologists have the tools to address and then just don't, or putting it in an article that nobody who really needs to read it ever reads. So that really does tie in this need for people who spend their lives trying to understand the world to learn how to express themselves in a way where they can have a meaningful impact on it. And yeah, it's time for a new era of public intellectualism. And I'm seeing it now all over, and especially at organizations like the AAA, which has done a lot, and our collaborations. I think that being an activist, it's important to get off Twitter and actually have a meaningful impact, do things like working in underserved communities.
So as you were talking, Phil, I was thinking about you went into this path of anthropology, full knowing that you wanted to use it to actualize the things that you wanted to do in the world, that your intention was to actually be applied and to make sure that you were making an impact in industry. And you spoke really eloquently about your take on ethics and how you approach it a certain way, even given your own life experiences and how that has made you empathetic to different kinds of people who have been disenfranchised. And it took me back to my own graduate experience, and I had to read this book, Parallel Worlds. I don't know if you have read this, and it's where this couple goes into field work. One of them is an anthropologist, one of them is a writer, and there is this scene in the book where the tribe that she being the anthropologist, is studying, there is a woman who has been like betrothed to another man, and she didn't want to get married to him, but it was important to do this in this particular culture because of the status of her family. And because she had run away several times after the wedding, there was a scene where there were men in her family who forced her to sleep with her husband, and the anthropologist was taking notes. And I remember in our seminar, our discussion was, would you take notes or would you intervene? And is either one of those things something that you should do? The status of her family. And because she had run away several times after the wedding, there was a scene where there were men in her family who forced her to sleep with her husband, and the anthropologist was taking notes. And I remember in our seminar, our discussion was, would you take notes or would you intervene? And is either one of those things something that you should do? And what does that mean? And that was one of the first times I really thought about my own personal ethics versus what I think of as like ethics with a big E. And I'm just really curious, like, how did you grapple with these types of really messy things, especially because in your educational experience, your intent was always to do this work, not only theorize about the work or think about it abstractly. So how did you start to put together what it is that you believed with maybe what your profession is also telling you, and this kind of weird tension that we have sometimes where we are the participant but also the observer?
I think really it's two things. One is due diligence, and the other, I guess, would be defensive driving. So due diligence really starts with understanding that to be an ethical anthropologist, you often have to do a lot more work on the front end to make sure that you're not going to be put in a situation that compromises your ethics. So for example, anthropologists are seldom whistleblowers because there are ethical implications with doing that. And you have to put yourself in a position where you don't have to be a whistleblower. That's different from other disciplines like investigative journalism. So it's really one, just thinking carefully about the situation I'm putting myself in. One example that's really interesting is my dissertation research, which was on the 30-meter telescope. And that was a really, at the time, kind of a boring project because it was basically how do astrophysicists and engineers and managers and big science pick a site for this telescope? And it didn't look like it was going to go to the controversial option until very late in the process. It looked like it would go to Chile. And so what's interesting about that is I did my due diligence. I met with another anthropologist who was studying this and interested in conducting research on this, and talked with the scientists and engineers and got a sense of the organization and put together my outline and my research plan, and didn't have any non-disclosure agreements, anything like that. And realizing that it would be really difficult to do work as an applied anthropologist in industry if you're working with an organization that's acting in bad faith or doing things that are ethically problematic, because eventually you're going to have to basically harm the people who have allowed you to collaborate with them in producing new knowledge. So that was my introduction to really thinking about how I would apply my ethics as an anthropologist. Now, that's not the end of the story. Years later, that became a massive controversy because they ended up picking a controversial site called Mauna Kea. But even back then, when they picked it, there was not the kind of visible opposition, the kind of signals that I expected. I thought that was when it was going to get really interesting. And it took a long time for that to become as interesting as I thought it would be. So basically making sure I'm not putting myself in a position where I'm going to have to push back in a way that's not tactful or leave a project or have to keep some secret or harm people who I've gotten to know and have worked with for a long time. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is defensive driving, where on an ongoing basis, so not just at the beginning, you can figure out how do you push back and reframe things and explain things and communicate clearly in a way where you're not going to find yourself co-opted. You need to be active in what you're doing and not just theorizing and problematizing, but being active, and it can push you out of your comfort zone. But I've been able to work on some amazing projects, and I know that I would not have had as meaningful an impact on society if I had been working in industry. So projects on helping decolonize technology. The TMT issue is an interesting one, but even in big tech realizes that they have to address a lot of problems. And this is a slow process. It's baby steps. But there are those kinds of situations. There's situations where you can help make sure a merger or acquisition is successful, because that's going to have implications for the livelihood of people who are involved. And you can do these in very fun ways too. I remember one example was at a workshop where two companies were coming together, and it was a merger, and it was a very, very high stakes merger. It was going to put the organization on the Fortune 500. And as a result of a lot of issues, it was something that was seen as very risky enough that an anthropologist could be hired to do an exploration of the cultural dimensions of this acquisition. And part of that project included having tropes on big scrolls at this workshop. So these are people in parts of society where they're not thinking about semiotics. They're worried about, they're generally, oftentimes they're going to be more conservative or business oriented or thinking about just business in a more traditional sense. But we listed these tropes out at this workshop. And tropes are basically just figures of speech, or it's figurative expression. So you can do a tropological analysis on how people express themselves figuratively. And oftentimes when people are saying things or expressing themselves in a very indirect way, that's going to have an enormous amount of meaning for people. And so we had tropes that we got from the interviews where people were rallying around these big scrolls and talking about, what are tropes? So I would explain to what tropes are. And then you would see something like, the CEO of this company has a secretary and she is the glue that holds the company together. So what does that actually mean? And we want to raise the bar. Or these kinds of expressions can be really, really meaningful, even though they seem like throwaway statements that we don't really pay attention to. But that's part of what you learn as an anthropologist, to zero in on those things that can have a lot of meaning, even if we use them constantly. And oftentimes it's because we're using them constantly that they're so meaningful. And that's a big reason why I went into industry as an anthropologist, was mass culture. Just, this is NBC growing up, watching The Cosby Show, watching the Doublemint Twins, or watching the Meow Mix and Friskies commercials. That was really interesting to me as somebody who was oriented towards the arts, because those are creative endeavors. But it was also really instrumental in why I became an anthropologist, because in order to understand why the arts have meaning and why communication and expression has meaning, you have to understand the cognitive processes and the cultural processes. And that's really what people are seeking when they're trying to find people who can help with their brand strategy or their design for product. I think that in a lot of ways, anthropology is fundamental to industry. And I think it's just becoming apparent now beyond these little pockets where, for example, in advertising, anthropologists have been used quite a bit. Also in private equity for things like due diligence. What's also interesting is that there are other pockets that probably need it the most where it hasn't been incorporated yet for cultural reasons, most likely. And so that one example is venture capital. Venture capitalists use fuzzier data points than private equity professionals do. So they really need anthropology. But that also ties into ethics, because now, as we're seeing a result of the implications of things like social media and AI, we're realizing that we need to go into these processes, these co-creative processes, in a way where we're not forgetting our humanity. And I think that's part of how an anthropologist can be an activist in an organization, being an advocate for the humans they're doing research with, but also just a humane perspective and a way to conduct business in a humane and humanistic way that's not going to perpetuate the kind of destructive things that we often talk about when we're talking about things like liberalism in the academy. So I feel like they're like the discipline of anthropology is evolving, and it's definitely timely, because there are a lot of problems that we can move from theorizing about to addressing, but bringing our perspective and being close to our humanity in a way that's not always possible when you're in a rat race, where you're really just focused on those metrics that are numbers and sales and dollar signs.
So it seems like the mission is we need to get more consultants that have some level of autonomy for how they can do the research and work. I think that's super valuable, though. I find the point inspiring, and I think it's quite interesting. So perhaps as a final turn for our conversation, you've mentioned public intellectualism a few times, and I know you and I are working on some projects, and so we could talk about those. I would set up a contrast that I think we can like dismantle. So it's a straw man, where on the one hand, I hear you saying that there are incredible capacities for activist work within organizations, especially if you're a consultant where you have some level of autonomy, but of course it could happen within an organization too. It just might be a little bit more difficult. On the other hand, you've also pointed out that anthropologists need to be advocates for humanity, right? And also a humane perspective to do business in more humane ways. And that could potentially also entail doing work in what we call public intellectualism. And so not all business context gets to translate into public intellectualism and vice versa. Not all public intellectual contexts would convert into business. And so I'm just wondering if you see any tension between what is the work we have to do to raise more public intellectuals who are anthropologists, mm-hmm. while at the same time thinking of sustainable ways to help anthropologists figure out how to get into business and to be more business savvy. Because I think something that we said at the outset is that so many anthropologists go to graduate school and they are not already where you were in terms of saying, okay, I want to go to industry from the first place. And I count myself in that category where mm-hmm. I originally thought, if I'm going to do a PhD, I want to at least know that I like teaching because that's the likely path. And then 1 year in, I started making a podcast because I was tired of academic ease. And then the latter 5 years was how to become applied and then work in industry. I guess I got there quickly, but still. But this idea of if some anthropologists are already ready to go into industry, but a lot of them are figuring that out for the first time, which is super exciting. I think you're right that we're in a new era now, that we're seeing the need for anthropology in the rest of the world. And I find inspiring that you always saw that and that you said that anthropology is fundamental to industry is super powerful. And my very long-winded back and forth question is, how do we think about this tension between public intellectuals on the one hand and doing activist work within businesses? And can those go hand in hand, or how do we help foster them together for new anthropologists and just folks like yourself too that are fighting on both sides of the fence? Or is there no fence between public intellectualism and doing work and consulting for businesses?
I think one thing that anthropologists need, and I think we do it naturally, sometimes it's very difficult, but we need humility and we need to realize that we can learn a lot from business. If you go on to Amazon and you search for books on culture or search for anthropology books, you find books written by people like venture capitalists and journalists. We can learn a lot from them. And so there's a really interesting idea that has shaped my work over the last year. And this idea actually came from Twitter, where I saw public intellectual trending. And I thought to myself, yeah, I know what a public intellectual is, but what's the difference between that and a thought leader? And so I did what you do as somebody who has an academic background, especially you find out, well, who's already done this work. You don't ever have to recreate the wheel. A lot of times people try to frame themselves as just making these new discoveries, but somebody's already done an analysis of the difference between public intellectuals and thought leaders. And it's something where his work aligns with my perspective a great deal, not completely. His name's Daniel Dresner, and he is a very prominent researcher in foreign relations. And so for me, I do have that consulting background. So I put together a little bit of a framework. So we have influencers, thought leaders, public intellectuals, and subject matter experts, and trying to understand what the difference is. And when I map those, I realize that thought leadership is really adjacent to public intellectualism. And in a lot of ways, thought leaders are a kind of influencer. In a lot of ways, public intellectuals are a subject matter expert. And when you talk about having societal impact, over the last few decades, it's really been thought leaders, especially from disciplines like journalism and people who work in industry, who talk about ideas that are researched very rigorously in academia and understood better and more deeply. But as a result of that depth and nuance that we have, it's very difficult to communicate that. So in a lot of ways, it's not that academics are just bad writers. It's just that we get hung up on the details and we get hung up on being accurate, that having that kind of an impact, the way a thought leader in business or journalism might, it's really difficult. It wasn't always like that. There was a time when newspapers would print Einstein's formulas, even though they didn't know what it meant, or people would know who Margaret Mead is and talk about her work, or Marvin Harris. So it's something where that pendulum, I think, is swinging back towards public intellectualism as a result of just the need. There's a need for understanding. I think that in 2020, there were three things that happened that I think about as shaping my career right now. One was you had people really just wanting to understand what was happening in the world. People who are intellectually curious, some of them are CEOs trying to understand what are the implications of climate change or structural violence or systemic racism on my organization. You had people having to go online to do work. So meetings where people used to go and listen to a panel, they had to be moved online. Research had to go online as well. So people were meeting online. And then lastly, you had this call to action among many different communities, like the anthropology community, us rallying around various initiatives, like the AAA is doing a few, and we are involved in those as well. But you had that where we just felt this call to action because we are the people who can provide understanding. That's really what public intellectualism is about. It's about providing understanding. Thought leaders are really good at proposing intriguing ideas based on work that they've done. So their expertise does not need to be anywhere as deep as a public intellectual's or a subject matter expert's, but they're able to convey these really interesting ideas. Public intellectuals are people who are going to talk about the nuances and the problems and push back when necessary and provide an actual understanding of what's happening, not just marketing ideas. And I think that as we work as anthropologists, we need to think about those as data sets. Look at public intellectuals, look at people like Noam Chomsky, right? And I'm thinking back, the last time I saw a public intellectual trending on Twitter, I think it was Noam Chomsky twice. He does not have a Twitter account, but he's always tried to engage the public through these conversations. Oftentimes it would be people who he disagrees with, but he's able to have a conversation where he is providing understanding by having a collaboration, even with somebody who might be an adversary on the political right or even on the political left. So I think that the intersection of public intellectualism and industry is really seeing how impactful professionals in industry have been, thought leaders, business leaders, CEOs. Why are they so good at that? It's because they're able to express themselves, but they don't have anywhere. And a lot of times they are basically evangelizing ideas that they've gotten from consultants that are white labeled. And I think that it's good that it's incorporated. For example, I remember we had a conversation a few months ago, Astrid, about Malcolm Gladwell. And I've never had anything against Malcolm Gladwell because I think of him as a thought leader. He has a lot of really interesting ideas and he's a great systems thinker. I always thought of him as somebody who can propose really good ideas. So I think that a lot of the problems that he's facing and a lot of that has been put on thought leaders and this kind of stereotype of them being vapid, self-absorbed people. I think a lot of the issue is actually that there is not enough public intellectualism to put that in check, where people are able to point out all the problems with these new ideas, but in doing so, co-create new knowledge and solutions that actually work. So thought leaders are great at packaging ideas, communicating them, writing books about them, and building media empires on them. Public intellectuals, our empires are very often internal and within our silos. And I think that now is the time for us to just learn what we need to from thought leaders while we are still bringing, and even maybe even influencers. How do people use social media? And I've even seen, and I think we also have to make sure that we don't let society and an interest in getting followers and traction on social media, even though that can be very lucrative, we need to make sure that we don't let society and the problems of society turn us into kind of thought leaders who are just marketing ideas and really getting caught up in our friends and followers and our platform and getting traction, getting book sales. So we need to figure out how can we be intellectually honest, public intellectuals, and get traction. And that really just there's no easy way to do that. It's a long, difficult applied anthropology project that I've been working on alongside people like you and Adam and Elizabeth Briody and a lot of people within anthropology. So I think it's time for us to start collaborating. And yeah, I think that's where we are right now.
I feel like that's a great call to action to end this. Thanks so much for your time, Phil. Mm-hmm. This has been amazing.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was great.
Many thanks once again to Phil Searles for joining us on This Anthro Life, and thanks to Astrid County for co-hosting today's episode. I'd love to hear your takeaways from today's episode. Feel free to shoot me a message at thisanthrolife@gmail.com, send me a message from our website, thisanthrolife.org, or hit me up on Twitter at thisanthrolife. How has your own identity shaped the way that you do your research, or the kind of impact you want to have as an anthropologist, social scientist, or just folk working for other human beings? Let me know in the comments and emails, and we will share some of your ideas going forward. The conversation was brought to you by myself, Sarah Schmieder, and Liz Smythe. Music from Epidemic Sounds, as always. Thank you so much for joining us. We are excited to keep bringing you more content here in 2021. It's been a pleasure, as always. We'll see you soon. This is Adam Gamwell. You're listening to This Anthro Life. We'll see you next time.